From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When he was a senior advisor to President Clinton, Sidney Blumenthal saw politics from inside the White House. Now that he's on the outside, he's used that perspective to observe and comment on the Bush administration in The Guardian of London and Slate. He's collected his columns since 2003 in a new book called How Bush Rules, Chronicles of a Radical Regime. It's published by Princeton University Press, and I'm pleased that it brings him back to my show today. It's always a pleasure.
Very nice to see you, Leonard, again.
When you were in the Clinton White House, were you able to ignore the journalist part of your brain?
No, actually. I had been a professional journalist for 27 years before I entered the White House, where I served in the second Clinton term. And you can't ignore what you've been doing as a professional for that long. And part of the job in any White House for anybody is to think about how the press is presenting what you're doing and your interactions with the press as well.
Well, in most cases, there's a honeymoon and then there is a bad period. But few White Houses have been as hostile to the press from the start, even though George Bush was not treated harshly by it at the beginning.
I believe that the Bush administration regarded the press as an enemy from the start.
But don't all administrations to some degree?
No, I don't necessarily think so. I think that they regard the press warily, that they're careful, that they think that some people are friendlier than others, some people are fairer than others, some people are more objective than others, some people don't like them. They make distinctions. As a whole, I believe that the Bush White House came in with a sensibility, and the sensibility was that the press is your enemy, that they have a liberal bias, that objective reporting contains a liberal bias, and there's a larger story, that the press is an institution devoted to undermining their largest goal, which is to create an executive that's unaccountable, that's insulated, that's protected, apart from checks and balances. And the press is one of the checks and balances. And this is something that if Bush didn't learn in Texas, which he didn't, it's certainly something that Cheney believed he had learned ever since he served in the Nixon White House.
But wasn't what happened to Bill Clinton an object lesson to some degree? After all, Bill Clinton, who is described generally as a liberal president, he was really, at the end, hounded by the press. The blue dress and all of that stuff, and Monica Lewinsky on the headlines every day. How did they see the press as anything other than, I wouldn't say conservative, because I guess the press sees its job as always trying to find the story behind the story.
Well, that's a very interesting question. And here's because I think that people in the Bush White House took two lessons out of the Clinton experience. One was that the press can hound you no matter who you are, and particularly if they tend to agree with you. And there was a continuity between what that press corps in Washington did to Clinton in attacking him and many of the same individuals and their complicity, is the word I would use, with Bush. There's no distinction here. Many of the people who were hostile to Clinton were the same people who were assiduously – there were some people who in the Bush White House who try and intimidate the press. They call the head of CEOs who own broadcast news organizations and editors and so on, and they relentlessly every day complain about stories and reporters and editors and so on, and they apply pressure and there's intimidation. That creates an atmosphere of self-censorship as well. On the other hand, there are people like Karl Rove who developed what amounted to his own personal fan club in the press corps, who acclaimed him as a genius, who he assiduously courted and worked with and spent time with. And he learned a different lesson. And until and even after the 2006 debacle, Rove was presented by these political reporters as the greatest, you know, architect, master strategist, genius of American politics ever.
You have called George Bush a radical. Most people would just call him a conservative. What's the difference?
I think that while Bush operates on the began to operate on the template of conservatism, he took it to a radical degree that no one had ever done before, including Ronald Reagan, who, after all, learned how to negotiate as a union leader and had good personal relations with the Democratic leadership of the Congress. Bush has no relations with anybody in the Congress. Bush is a radical in that he has repudiated traditional Republicanism across the board, beginning with a realist foreign policy as practiced by not only his father but Republican presidents before him, like Eisenhower, limited government. We have the largest government we've ever had. Fiscal responsibility. We have the largest deficit we've ever had, blown out. Separation of church and state. He's invaded that consistently with his policies from stem cell research to the Terry Schiavo case, where he trampled on the right to privacy, another cherished traditional Republican value. So I would say he's a radical and that he's a uniquely radical president.
But don't Americans tend to be frightened of radicalism? So how has he been able to put so many of what you consider to be extreme policies in place?
Well, as I try and lay out in the book, you have to see this in terms of the chronology as it happened. He comes into office having campaigned as a compassionate conservative, a united, not a divider. Somebody would change the tone in Washington. If you remember one of the debates with Al Gore, he even proclaimed that he was for a humble foreign policy and attacked Al Gore for mistreating Muslims accused of terrorism in one of the debates. Then he gets in, and even before 9/11, he's quite radical in overthrowing the foreign policy consensus of about 60 years. He throws over Kyoto, the Chemical and Biological Warfare Treaty. He throws out all the negotiations on Korea that were near fulfillment. He throws out the Middle East peace process. All this happens before 9/11. Then he gets turbocharged by 9/11, and he's sort of he's sort of infused with a life that allows his radicalism to really flourish. And he presents himself as the one who's fighting Islamic extremism, just as he practices and advances his radicalism here.
My guest is Sidney Blumenthal, whose book, How Bush Rules, Chronicles of a Radical Regime, is published by Princeton University Press. Well, he also, in the debate with Gore, said that he was opposed to nation building. And you, if I remember correctly, were kind of optimistic about the Bush presidency at the very beginning.
I don't know. I was certainly wary of the kind of politics that was practiced, which we saw in evidence in the Florida contest with Gore. And that's another aspect of his radicalism, is this kind of extremist politics where the social issues are inflamed precisely in order to arouse the hardcore conservative base for maximum turnout. This is the Rove strategy, and that's a very particular kind of radicalism.
It isn't just good politics. We always expect politicians to lie during campaigns and then do what they want to do once they get in power. And then the hard part, of course, is getting the rest of the country and Congress to go along with them.
I think there are alternative possibilities that sort of the what-ifs of history involving Bush. What if Bush had governed as he had campaigned in 2000? And was a sort of new improved version of his father without the flaws? What if he had included Democrats in his cabinet, especially a war cabinet after 9/11, in important positions? President Kennedy in the Cold War had Republicans as Secretary of Defense and Secretary of the Treasury. I mean, this is President Clinton had a Republican as Secretary of Defense. Bush doesn't do that. On this non-existent mandate that he wins in 2000, he moves very rapidly to a right-wing position. What if he had tried to negotiate with the Congress? I think he could have been a fairly successful president. In the end, this radicalism creates a downward spiral, as we've seen in the 2006 midterm elections, and feeds on itself.
But it took a long time.
It took a long time.
6 years. Of course, 9/11 is a reason that everything changed for a while. But still, I mean, if he was that radical, always that radical?
Well,
is this Karl Rove the radical? Who's the radical here?
Well, that's a good question. But, as you pointed out before, the public didn't get a lot of help from the press. And the public had to do this on its own. It took them 6 years in working through all these events involving the trauma of 9/11, especially. Who is the radical? Well, I think Bush has a very radical sensibility, who sees things in black and white, who thinks he's on a mission, even a religious mission. But who is the radical? Dick Cheney's the radical. Dick Cheney is the one who has, from the beginning, the real idea of this particular imperial presidency that evolved from his experiences, beginning in the Nixon White House, then as chief of staff to President Ford, seeing the presidency curbed by the Congress, by an invigorated press corps. And his lesson from Watergate was more or less to burn the tapes. He wanted to create a presidency that was unbound, unfettered.
So now that James Baker has been brought in, will he be setting the tone and taking it away from Dick Cheney?
I think that there is a conflict going on between Cheney and James Baker, the former Secretary of State, who's now head of what's called the Iraq Study Group, that is to report to the president shortly on new proposals for Iraq. Baker is the consummate realist. Baker was a highly successful Secretary of State for Elder Bush, remains close to him. And I covered that administration. I had worked for the National Staff of the Washington Post, then the New Republic, and then the New Yorker when that administration went out. Baker and Cheney did not get along at all. They were antagonists by the end of the Elder Bush administration. And I believe that what we're seeing is a kind of kabuki in the press. I believe that Cheney is doing everything he can to undermine what Baker's trying to do, which is, in effect, to reinvent U.S. foreign policy in the midst of this fiasco, to come up with a diplomacy that might somehow create a larger process to cope with this. And Cheney is fighting a last-ditch effort. In a way, if you take Cheney's phrase about the insurgency in Iraq, the last throws, this battle with Baker might be Cheney's last throws.
Although it's interesting, I don't know if you've seen Christian Alfonsi's new book. It turns out that Cheney was one of the people who felt that the U.S. military should not go any further at the end of the Gulf War. He was one of the advocates for limiting that war. The book is called Circling the Sand, by the way, because he spoke to Cheney in the late 90s. So people have changed, and Dick Cheney seems to have gone pretty far in a direction that you might not have been able to predict if you looked at the first Bush White House.
Well, I'm not sure about that. I think that Cheney has been a figure who has been misunderstood by people in the elder Bush circle. I don't think that they've understood how radical he was and how right-wing he was. When he supported the position of not marching to Baghdad in the first Gulf War, he was on board with the official position of the president, President Bush, National Security Advisor Scowcroft, Brent Scowcroft, Secretary of State Baker. That was the and Colin Powell, who was then the general of the armies. So that was the position, and Cheney was on board. And as Secretary of Defense, he was also reflecting the consensus of the generals, of the Joint Chiefs. They didn't want to go to Baghdad at all and occupy that. But I think that if you look, the deeper you scratch into Cheney's history, the more you find how radical he was, going back to the Nixon and the Ford era, where he and Rumsfeld did everything they could to move Ford to a right-wing position, and undermined Henry Kissinger in his pursuit of détente, helped create what was called Team B to attack the CIA's assessments of the Soviet Union, which they regarded as too weak, too soft, underestimating their military prowess. I think that, and then Cheney's career in the Congress as well, defending Iran-Contra as an example of executive power that should not be looked into.
My guest is Sidney Blumenthal, former assistant and senior advisor to President Bill Clinton, now a regular columnist for The Guardian of London and for Salon. His latest book is called How Bush Rules, Chronicles of a Radical Regime, published by Princeton University Press. We'll continue right after this. We're back with Sidney Blumenthal. His latest book, How Bush Rules, Chronicles of a Radical Regime, is published by Princeton University Press. On Monday, NBC announced that it would start calling the situation in Iraq a civil war, and several other news organizations have followed suit. Do you think that's a fair characterization?
I think it's been a civil war for a long time, however you want to define a civil war. It doesn't have to meet the precise template of the U.S. Civil War or other civil wars where there are clear sides. This is its own kind of a civil strife, civil war.
And CNN is reporting today that Colin Powell told a gathering in Dubai that we can call the situation in Iraq a civil war, and that if he were still Secretary of State, he would recommend the Bush White House describe the situation in a way that reflects conditions on the ground there.
Well, Powell must be angry to do that. It's he doesn't have to do that. It's a it is a move that politically undermines the Bush administration. On the day that President Bush is meeting with Iraqi Prime Minister Maliki. And the use of the term civil war does undermine the Iraqi government because it demonstrates its weakness. So for Powell to do that reflects his, besides his frankness, but also his calculated hostility to the Bush administration and his simmering resentment over his experience in it.
But there are real problems that have to be addressed. CNN is also reporting that Muqtada al-Sadr's loyalists have announced they're leaving the unity government in Iraq because they threatened to, I guess, if he Ibn Maliki met with President Bush. And then, of course, there's a story in today's Times, National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley's memo to President Bush questioning the ability of Nouri al-Maliki to establish some control over the violence in Iraq.
I read the Hadley memo, the complete memo, which is in the Times today. I found it an extraordinary memo for several reasons. One, there's a part in it where it factually describes how Maliki is undermining U.S. goals and contributing to the civil war in Iraq. Then there's an entire fantasy section about how a new political base could be created for Maliki, and we could try and do that. He'd be given new constituencies that we're making up. As somebody who has written memos for president, I found this extraordinary that you'd have a fantasy-based memo. I understand that there are, you know, you write down options and you can suggest best and worst-case scenarios, but this is sheer fantasy, totally contradicted by the factual part of the memo. And what it suggests is not simply that Maliki is a very weak leader with very little control over the situation in Iraq, and not only that we have very little control over him, but that our administration is pretty much clueless.
And now we have a Shiite undermining Maliki rather than the Sunnis, who were assumed to be the ones who were most hostile to this government, because Maliki has been accused by some of allowing Shiite violence, of allowing secret police and others to also act as death squads.
Well, Maliki stopped the U.S. from going after a militia, so-called militia leader, who may just be a terrorist gangster, who was a Shiite, because he was part of the al-Sadr Mahdi army, which al-Sadr may not completely control at this point. There are reports that he only controls about a third of his own militia. For him, he has been a chief pillar of support for the Maliki government, and the reason that Maliki is in power. If he withdraws support, this may presage the collapse of this very weak government. And no one knows where it goes. If I were Maliki and read this memo in the Times, leaked clearly by the administration to appear on the day that I was meeting with President Bush, I would be extremely wary and do everything I could to ensure that my bodyguard was secure.
Who do you think would have leaked it?
I think that this was obviously leaked from the top, by someone at the direction of the administration. There have been a series of concerted leaks all week, and it's hard to understand what they're trying to do, what it adds up to. This one, in particular, is a contribution to the new talking point that we've liberated the Iraqi people and they're to blame for their own chaos. And so this is an attempt to lay down blame before the failure of the meeting with Maliki and Bush, expecting that it will fail to produce anything.
Also, a lot of blame being placed on al-Qaeda, despite the fact that there was no al-Qaeda in Iraq before the invasion.
Well, Bush made a statement in Riga at a NATO meeting yesterday, I believe, saying that al-Qaeda was responsible for the violence in Iraq, whereas we now have Colin Powell today saying that it's a civil war. Al-Qaeda's not maybe a factor in that. Our military intelligence has shown before the elimination of Zarqawi, the head of the group called al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, that the foreign fighters perhaps constituted 7% of the Sunni insurgency, which is a very complex insurgency. So for Bush to do this is really just a propaganda point intended to continue to enthrall the American imagination and try and continue support for a policy that has no idea, according to the Hadley memo, of how to deal with the facts on the ground as they exist.
Is this an attempt to lower expectations?
It's an attempt to mobilize and galvanize his support. I don't know what his statement does in terms of lowering expectations. I think the leak of the Hadley memo is intended to lower expectations, which would be a euphemism for saying that they expect nothing from Maliki and that they're blaming him and the Iraqis for the accumulated blunders of the administration.
My guest is Sidney Blumenthal, who is a columnist for The Guardian of London and Salon.com, a former staff writer for The Washington Post, The New Yorker, and The New Republic, and also former assistant and senior advisor to President Clinton, author of numerous books, the most recent, How Bush Rules, Chronicles of a Radical Regime, published by Princeton University Press. Well, talking about leaks, you've dedicated your book to Joseph C. Wilson IV, the diplomat who criticized the Bush administration, and that led to the leak of his wife's name. First of all, why him of all people?
Joe Wilson and I are close personal friends. Our families are close. My wife and I are very close to Joe and Valerie, his wife. Joe and I actually share a birthday, and we had Thanksgiving together with our children. Joe was the head of the Africa section of the National Security Council in the Clinton White House when I served there. I greatly admire his fortitude, bravery, and patriotism in standing up for, in serving the country, going on missions for the country, even after more than 20 years of being in the Foreign Service, and standing up for the truth about what he did and what the government did in terms of the rationale for the invasion of Iraq, and then standing up to the smear campaign against him.
Now, most people assume that that smear campaign was coming out of the vice president's office, but were you surprised to learn that Bob Novak and Bob Woodward both had that information leaked by Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage?
I was not surprised and had heard that at least, 8 months or a year before it had appeared. I think that the Armitage leak of Valerie Plame's name to Novak and Woodward was not the only leak going on. There was certainly an operation run at the instigation of Vice President Cheney in which many members of the White House staff, from Scooter Libby, his chief of staff, to Karl Rove and others, were involved in trying to get the press to publish Valerie Plame's identity as an undercover CIA operative in order to try and discredit Joe Wilson and the truth that he was telling about his mission, about what he didn't find in Africa, about Saddam Hussein's a non-pursuit of yellowcake uranium for nuclear weapons. So I think that Armitage is one figure in this very complex story, and the revelation of his name in no way should overshadow the intent of the vice president and his men to smear, discredit Wilson and destroy the career of a valuable CIA operative who was, in fact, working on weapons of mass destruction.
Well, the Bush administration has done that to some other people as well. Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, the former CENTCOM commander Tony Zinni, for example. But isn't that typical in Washington? Don't administrations always do a little smear of the people, the insiders, who can embarrass them?
I think that this is an extraordinary progression, a procession of smears of people. You mentioned Paul Neal, the former Secretary of the Treasury, who told the true story of what happened to him on economic policy. If you recall, he was threatened with being prosecuted for leaking classified information, which he was not and cleared about, but that succeeded in intimidating him and shutting him down from talking about the contents of his book. That's typical of the kinds of behavior that's gone on in this administration, even and especially towards those career staff professionals in the intelligence community, the senior military, and the Foreign Service, all of who've been under extraordinary pressures to violate professional standards in order to pursue the Bush administration's goals.
Everybody seems to be giving the new Democratic leadership in Congress advice. Many have said they should try to practice bipartisanship. Others have said really have to do investigations and do the opposite of what we've been seeing so far. What are your feelings?
Well, as a political matter, it's certainly important for the Democratic leadership to say that it wishes to operate in a spirit of bipartisanship, and one does wish that President Bush would sign legislation that a Democratic Congress may well pass in its first 100 hours, as the leadership has spoken about, new minimum wage bill, a reduction of the cost of prescription drugs for senior citizens, lowering the cost of student tuition loans, stem cell research. It'd be good if the president were to sign that.
We're probably going to see a lot of vetoes for the first time.
Right. On the other hand, it's absolutely obligated by the Constitution that the Congress engage in oversight and investigation. That is its job as a co-equal branch of government. It doesn't mean that it engages in witch hunts, as happened under McCarthy, or that it engage in partisan-driven impeachment trials, as what happened with Clinton, but that, in fact, there be a very serious and professional oversight of what goes on in this administration. That's part of our system of checks and balances.
What about the way Nancy Pelosi has been addressed since the election? She has been depicted as a kind of a wild woman for a number of decisions she's made. Yesterday, she decided not to give the chairmanship of the House Intelligence Committee to Alcee Hastings, but she has been depicted in the press as a kind of a runaway train.
Well, to the extent that the press picks up the Republican talking points, then they are continuing their embedded performance from the whole Bush period. I think that Nancy Pelosi, in her decision about who should be the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, has been quite deft. That's a very difficult decision and a complex one involving her relationship with the former ranking Democrat from her own home state of California, Jane Harman, who's very knowledgeable.
But been a lot more hawkish than Nancy Pelosi.
And with whom she has a prickly relationship. Alcee Hastings, who was impeached for corruption and yet was supported by many members of the Congressional Black Caucus. And Pelosi has decided on neither of those as the chairman and will pick a third party. I think that that is the shrewd and correct thing to do. It would have been disastrous had she picked Hastings under these circumstances to have as a chairman of House Intelligence. It would have been a continual open wound for the Democrats.
Sidney Blumenthal's How Bush Rules, Chronicles of a Radical Regime is published by Princeton University Press. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you, Leonard.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.